Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Okay, it's Monday and it's 11:59. We're a minute before for schedule there, Dave.
I've got noon in here, actually.
Oh, really? Okay, my clock is a little slow. All right.
The psycho clock.
No, I have straight up 12 o'clock on my clock, too. So there you go. You are right. Well, after we've established what time it is, now we can tell you what this is. This is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and you are listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we have a really, because I am both host and producer, I have a really great show for you today. But first, we have my favorite part of the day, which is joys and sorrows. Yes, I spend hours, sometimes days, collecting this information for your benefit, my dear listeners. At first, I want to celebrate the joy of the fact that the Dakota Access Pipeline has been at least somewhat sidelined for the moment. The Army Corps of Engineers, in case you've been living under a rock, has decided that they will not route it through the Indian Reservation that they were planning to do. The only question in my mind is, why the hell did it take them so frickin' long? I mean, those people have been freezing their buns off now for weeks and weeks and weeks. I mean, just outrageous. The whole idea was outrageous. The idea that it took this long for the Army Corps of Engineers to make the right decision is outrageous. Outrageous that the Obama administration didn't step in right away and put the kibosh on this idea. All in all, I am still outraged on their behalf, but I am truly glad and joyful that that the pipeline, for the moment anyway, has been shelved. Unfortunately, I suspect that there are greater outrages in our future under the new regime. We won't call it a presidency. We will call it a regime because that's what it's going to be. A little bit of a sorrow here. This is sort of interesting. I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time reading the trades. So a lot of my information comes from trade magazines. And of course, one of my favorite ones is Global Meat News. I urge you all to check out Global Meat News. It's a real bellwether for what's happening in the world in many, many ways. You'd be surprised at how much you can extrapolate from the information in Global Meat News. But one thing I did find out today is that sadly, the avian flu, otherwise known as bird flu, has been ongoing in Europe and in Asia over the last few weeks, and quite seriously so in Japan, and probably pretty seriously so in Europe, although they're not really, really reporting all their numbers yet. But since it is transmitted by wild bird droppings, it is entirely likely that we will see it here in the U.S. sooner rather than later. We probably already have a few cases, but it hasn't come on to the 2015 saw a huge outbreak and literally millions of birds slaughtered as a result. So later on in the show, we're going to be talking about price fixing in the poultry market. But in fact, the bird shortages from avian flu could well occur quite naturally and have the same impact of raising prices in as much alongside of the price fixing that has been going on in the poultry industry over the last year or so. You're going to learn a lot about that in just a minute. We're going to have a great show with the wonderful, the excellent, and the most prolific journalist, Christopher Leonard, author of The Meat Racket, one of my favorite books and something that everyone should have on their reading list. And by the way, in other meaty news for you, the USDA and the Food Safety and Inspection Service is mulling over revising the nutritional facts panel on meat products. So in addition to updating the daily reference values based on current dietary recommendations, they are also proposing to change the labeling requirements for food, quote, aimed specifically at children under four and lactating women, as well as developing nutrient reference values for those groups. Now, I think that's interesting. for various reasons. But what really interests me is that they don't label these products as having significant risk factors for those groups, as well as the elderly, because most chicken in this country carries a significant quantity of drug-resistant pathogens, primarily salmonella. And those are particularly dangerous to pregnant women, to children, and to the elderly. So I was thinking of something along the lines of like the warning label on a pack of smokes. You know what I mean? Like warning, the Surgeon General advises you. Yeah, I mean, they really should have. They do have, you know, cooking temperatures. They tell you to cook it up to a certain degree. But there really should be a warning label about the pathogens on meat products in this country, because quite honestly, you splash some water around with some salmonella and it sticks to your sink, to your sponge, to your, you know, dishcloth, whatever. I mean, I am increasingly hypervigilant about poultry and how I process it in my own kitchen. Not that I buy a lot of commercial poultry, but I do. I buy, you know, what is, you know, sort of mainstream Bell and Evans or, you know, organic poultry products. And because they are mass produced, they're going to have a lot of the same issues. So even if you buy those organic things, don't imagine to yourselves that that they're any safer, because quite honestly, they probably won't be. Another meaty thing that I learned today in Global Meat News, or maybe it was Food Navigator, another one of my favorite sites, Mark Post, the man behind the fake meat, the test tube meat. He created this product at the University of Maastricht a few years ago. I think it was 2013. And the first go round of it cost something like $100,000 to produce the equivalent of a burger. He's now got the price down to about $11 per burger size serving. But he is predicting that within 7 years, we will be seeing his product in grocery stores. So you heard it here first. In 7 years, we'll all be eating burgers made out of animal protein that has been cultured in a petri dish or in a test tube. I think that's a pretty interesting prospect. And lastly, this is a sorrow. This will be my last little entry for this week. But there is a wonderful Dutch organization called Food Watch, and that awards something called the Golden Egg to products with the most misleading labels And in 2016, I am devastated to announce that my very favorite caffeinated beverage, Red Bull, has been included. Apparently, it doesn't give you wings. It gives you love handles and sleepless nights. Who knew? And I'm sorry to say that on top of my morning Red Bull, I am now also ingested the better part of a cup of coffee. So if my speech becomes increasingly unintelligible, you will know that it's because I am like, I'm driving a train loaded on caffeine. So with that, my friends, I will allow my dear Dave, the engineer, to run our sponsor drop. And then we will be right back with the incredible Chris Leonard. We're going to have a wonderful conversation. So please stay tuned and listen up and pay attention to our sponsor drop. And we'll see you in just a second.
And this one's called Poetry Is Dead by Teeth People. We'll be right back.
She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot. And she don't know that she's her.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
That's right. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. This is your host, Katie Kiefer, at the microphone. And on the telephone with me today is Chris Leonard. Christopher Leonard is a former national business reporter for the Associated Press. His work has appeared in Fortune, Bloomberg Businessweek, Slate, and the Wall Street Journal. He is a Schmidt Family Foundation Fellow with the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy institute in Washington, D.C. His first book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, brought him here to this show in 2014. And he is now working on his second book, A Profile of Coke Industries. And by the way, he had a fantastic piece on Bloomberg. No, yeah, Bloomberg News, I think last week, about the pipeline break in Alabama and the multiple pipeline breaks, I should say, in Alabama that speaks to the dwindling infrastructure in the oil business, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, I urge you to read that. And in the meantime, welcome to the show, Chris. Thanks so much for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I really appreciate your time. I loved that article, by the way. Tell me the title. It was on Bloomberg News, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was in Business Week, and the title was A Pipeline Runs Through It, based on that novel, you know, A River Runs
yes.
Through It, because part of it is it goes by this really ecologically sensitive river called the Cahaba River in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a very good story and something that we should all be thinking about, because all of that pipeline infrastructure is really pretty old at this point, isn't it? I mean, wasn't that an example of a pipeline that's been around? I don't know if you said this in the article. I don't remember it. But it seems to me that most of the pipeline in this country was laid quite a while ago. And just like our bridges and our roads, it probably needs a lot of attention that it's not getting.
Exactly. The pipeline at the center of that article was built in 1962.
Oh, geez.
A lot of the pipeline we have is that old and aging, and I'm sure you saw in the news today a pipeline in North Dakota near the Standing Rock Indian Reservation was just blocked, and that's just one piece of a large movement against new pipeline construction across the United States. So
yeah.
We're seeing aging infrastructure and this sort of intense debate about whether or not we should build new infrastructure that would lock us into more fossil fuel use for 40, 50 years.
Absolutely. I know it's a perplexing problem, because building new pipelines means fewer of these accidents and spills, but also, as you point out, it means more that we'll be continuing to use them in the coming 50 years until they start breaking down again. And by then, I hope we have some other form of energy. Anyway, let's talk about what you've been doing. So you have been working on a new book. You have been working on a new article, I should say, that is going to be appearing sometime soon, that talks about antitrust and the monopolization of the meat industry. So can we start this segment by talking about the history of the consolidation of the meat industry and the sort of impact of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which happened, 70 years ago, 80 years ago?
Oh, more than that. I mean, the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in the 1890s.
Oh, of course it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then you saw more laws added on top of that, the Clayton Act,
mm-hmm.
Hart-Rodino, and things along those lines more recently. So, but yeah, I mean, antitrust enforcement has been around for a long time, and kind of paradoxically, we've seen just greater and greater consolidation in lots of industries in the U.S., but really particularly in the meat business.
Mm-hmm. Meat and agriculture in general, because, of course, we've seen this wave of consolidation in the seed industry and in the agricultural chemical industries with the mm-hmm. Monsanto Bayer, with DuPont Pioneer, and Syngenta, et cetera. But the Sherman Antitrust Act was meant to break up the monopolies of four big meat packers, as you say, back in the 1890s, early 20th century. And why isn't the Sherman Act and the subsequent Clayton Act and the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act in 1978, why are they not doing the same job now? What's happened?
So a lot has happened. And I mean, quickly, maybe it's helpful to kind of talk about why those laws were passed in the first place.
Yes.
When 100 years ago, just like you said, there were five companies known as the, quote, meat trust that had tremendous control over the national market for meat. And what they did was they used the monopolist's playbook that really hasn't changed in 200 years. And here's how it works. These companies like Armour and Swift had so much control over the national market that they became really powerful middlemen. And what they did was twofold. First of all, they depressed what they paid to farmers and ranchers to raise animals. They artificially lowered the prices that they paid for their product, which squeezed farmers and ranchers. And then they turned around on the opposite side and they artificially raised prices and made meat more expensive for consumers. So when you do that, you capture the outsized profits in the middle. And of course, they did all kinds of other stuff, like bought Congress people and had really reprehensible conditions in their plants, et cetera. But I think the basic mechanisms that we care about are those two, where they depress what they pay farmers and they raise prices for consumers. So people were furious about this. I mean, there was just broad public distaste and outcry for this kind of corporate control that existed for decades in the United States, and it took a lot of work, not just to get these antitrust laws passed, but to get them actively enforced. And that's what you really saw starting to happen in the early 1920s, is the federal government stepped in and tried to break apart these monopolies, because when a company gains a sort of monopoly position in the marketplace, by definition, the market can't heal itself. These firms are distorting the laws of supply and demand, and the market can't really heal itself anymore. So the federal government stepped in to break apart these monopolies and restore competition, and it was really remarkably successful. Let's just take the period of, 1945 up to about 1978, and you saw that the grasp and control of the meat trust was thoroughly broken. We had lots of producers. We had lots of competition. We had lots of innovation in the meat industry. It was what I kind of call plug-and-play capitalism, where you have a smart entrepreneur in Iowa who wants to raise hogs. Well, they can get into this market because it's open, it's competitive, and they can raise products and sell them in transparent marketplaces. And that's what we saw for decades in the United States.
That's right. And what's interesting to me about this is that, when you talk about sort of the meat trust, we have that now. We have four major meat packers in this country. When you talk about deplorable conditions, we have that now in every single meat packing plant, basically, that's run by most of these people. I mean, I shouldn't say every single one, but the conditions really are deplorable, especially in the poultry industry. So nothing there has changed. What else can we draw parallels with? Beating farmers down on price. I wanted to ask you about that for a second, because the way they did it, the way they do it now, is that because the industry has consolidated to only just really a few companies controlling almost all of the processing in the United States, that means that farmers can only go to certain processors sort of within whatever, however many hundreds or thousands of miles near them. And that requires accepting the prices that they are offered because they don't have any place else to go with their products. Was that the same in the 1890s and early 20th century, that there was a limited amount of processing available and that's how they were able to squeeze the farmers and ranchers? Or was it a different mechanism at that time?
It was similar. It was very similar, except really the truth is it is worse today.
Yeah.
Okay, the meat trust that exists today has far more market concentration than that existed 100 years ago. Today, four companies control 85% of the beef processing. Three poultry companies control almost half of the national market for chicken. So today, the venues that farmers have to choose between, to sell into, the people who they can do business with are fewer than really any time in U.S. history. But there's kind of another story here that's really important for this, which is that your farmer today is very, very different from the farmer of 1915, because I think of a poultry farmer today as really being like a mid-sized or small factory owner.
Absolutely.
I mean, this will be a couple or an individual that has borrowed $2 million to build a complex of maybe seven very large warehouses where they'll raise tens of thousands of birds at a time with automatic feeders, automatic watering systems, et cetera. So the farmers of today are much larger in scale. They're much more industrialized. And yet, when they have, when they face a market to sell their products to, like you say, let's just look at poultry farmers. It was shocking to me. That's how the meat racket started. Is years ago, as a reporter covering this business, and you see these really high-tech chicken houses, and the whole infrastructure around it is really astounding. But you turn around to try to sell these animals, and these farmers, have one company to sell to realistically in many cases. I mean, they are facing not some abstract, but a very real monopoly. In a town like Waldron, for example, Waldron, Arkansas, where I did a lot of reporting for the book, these farmers, many of them, there's only one company in their geographic area that they could sell to, and they had no choice but not just to take the price that Tyson Foods offered them, but to operate under all the conditions that Tyson dictated. I mean, the imbalance of power is just really incredible.
Yeah, and I think it bears stressing that if you are somebody who owns 20,000 birds, you must have a packer who can take those birds all at once and then distribute them. It's not like you, the farmer, can like get your truck, take them, you know, some a few hundred birds somewhere else and then, you know, distribute them yourself or something like that. It's not possible with those kinds of numbers. And yet, in order to survive in the poultry industry as a grower, you must do that many numbers. So it's they really do have people hamstrung by this lack of processing options. And I think that's something that most people never really think about when they think about how this whole system works. And this is also true in the hog industry and to a certain extent in the cattle industry. And there was a lot of, as you know, there was a lot of, well, we're going to get into it in a second. So I'm going to move on. I'm not going to go on yapping because nobody's tuning in to listen to me talk. They're listening to you. So let me ask you one more question about these rules, about these laws that were passed, including the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act in 1978, which says that firms must notify the antitrust authorities of their intent to merge and allow the transaction to be reviewed before it is executed. And then on top of that, there are also the Grain Inspection Packers Stockyard Act, GIPSA, rules that are supposed to guarantee fair prices and fair competition. Now, why are none of these controls effective? Like, is that because there's no enforcement? Is it because, I don't know, because there's no enforcement?
if only it was just that. I mean, this is the million-dollar question. You know, uh-huh. I just said maybe a few minutes ago that by the 70s we had this really competitive, vigorous, open market mm-hmm. for producing meat. What the heck happened? Great yeah. question. The Hart-Rodino Act that you just mentioned is in force fully today mm-hmm. and requires any companies that want to merge to submit to federal authorities who need to approve that merger on the basis of competition. So how in the heck did we get to this point today where three companies control half the chicken market and can control what they pay farmers? Lots of things happen. Let me just, you know, one quick thing. This stuff is complicated and is sort of invisible to most people. But yeah. let's just take one really important example. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, he appointed a guy named William F. Baxter to be head of antitrust enforcement. Mm. And William F. Baxter sends out a memo to the Department of Justice antitrust enforcement team to say, hey, we're going to change how we regulate competition. All these companies are going to submit petitions to us to merge, and we're going to think about it in a different way. Instead of caring about consolidation alone, you know, instead of blocking mergers just because it'll give companies a large share of the market, we're going to focus on efficiency or the price to consumer. And what I mean by that is we will let these firms merge. We'll let these industries get highly consolidated as long as the companies can prove to us that each merger is going to save money for the consumer. It was really a radical departure from previous decades of antitrust enforcement. You know, my dad was a Republican corporate attorney who specialized in antitrust, and I remember him telling me antitrust cases dropped off a cliff in the 80s.
No
they
kidding.
Just disappeared for this reason.
Wow.
Now, we're learning a lesson from this, which is that when you let the business consolidate and when you let the structure change so much, even when these companies say, hey, if you let us get bigger, we're going to make things cheaper, you start to see the effects of monopoly power exert themselves over time, even if the upfront argument is that we can do it cheaper because we're going to be bigger, et cetera. And I think that there's evidence that that's what we've seen. But regardless, during the 80s and 90s, under this new regime, you just see a sweeping wave of mergers occur. And the market power of the few remaining firms who bought out all their competitors just rises dramatically. And then quickly, I don't want to just go on too much, but you know, you talk about, okay, fine, so that happens. But then what about the fact that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has an entire office whose job is to do nothing but to police antitrust statutes for farmers? I mean, that's literally what they do every day when they come to work. And that's a really, really interesting story with a lot of history. But I'll just put it this way, which is that, you know, this is a political organization with people who run it. And I interviewed a lot of the people that ran this agency over the decades, called the Packers and Stockyards Administration. Mm-hmm. And they make political decisions about what they're going to do. And it is just documented that they decided not to vigorously enforce these laws that were created in the 1920s under the Packers and Stockyards Administration. Don't take my word for it. There's GAO report after GAO report from the 90s talking about papers being hidden in drawers, complaints never Wow. followed up on, a dysfunctional system. Mm-hmm. And so you got the regulators not going after it as aggressively, and then quickly to end this, they, you know, lawyers are real, real smart people, and these companies can hire the best and the brightest lawyers, and they had a very smart tactic of suing the Packers and Stockyards Administration, or defending suits in a way that reshaped the law over time. There were a number of appeals courts decisions that found that if I, Chris Leonard, chicken farmer, want to sue Tyson Foods under the Packers and Stockyards Act, I have to prove that Tyson's action toward me didn't just hurt me, but hurt the entire state of competition. Mm. That putting my chicken business, my chicken farm out of business, has to harm the entire state of competition in the national chicken market. That was an almost unprovable burden, and that's why you've seen cases under the PSA really decline. And the agency, according to people inside of it, really lost its teeth thanks to this string of appeals court rulings.
Fascinating, Chris. Oh my God, we could do a whole show just on that. But let us, as you say, let us move on, because as you reported in the article that I picked up on in the Food and Environmental Reporting Network in Fern, there was an effort by Tom Vilsack in 2011 to impose some new reforms on the industry, but there was so much pushback from industry and from Congress, our paid for, bought and sold congressional representatives, that nothing happened. So just give us a thumbnail of what that battle was about, and what was the USDA and farmers and ranchers, what were they trying to achieve? Were they trying to, like, push back on some of this price fixing? Were they seeking antitrust regulations? What exactly were they looking for?
Sure, you bet. First of all the stuff I just described has been well documented in the public record and has been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. So by the year 2008, when Barack Obama is elected, you have had farmers from across rural America filing lawsuits, complaining to their representatives in Iowa. Senators in Iowa like Harkin and Grassley have been mm-hmm. trying to beat this drum that we've entered sort of a new era of corporate power in this realm. And so Obama is elected and hires a team of pretty hardcore reformers to head up this USDA agency I mentioned, the Packers and Stockyards Administration. And mm-hmm. they say, hey, we are going to come in here and address these concerns that have been expressed in political venues and lawsuits for years. Mm-hmm. And they proposed a new set of rules that would change the power relationship and essentially strengthen the antitrust laws. Just one of the rules would have undone that whole thing about harm to competition that I just talked about,
right.
that big barrier to filing a PSA suit. I mean, Vilsack told me that was an unrealistic threshold, basically, for a lawsuit, and they were going to try to undo that and put out clear guidance from USDA that would sort of overturn or speak clearly against these appeals court's decisions. So anyway, there was a raft of stuff that they proposed doing when Obama came into office that gets down into sort of the mechanics of how these companies can depress prices to farmers. That was really sort of the ground zero for this fight, was farmers not being economically exploited by these companies. The consumer stuff sort of comes later. And short story, they proposed these rules and just got their lunch eaten by the meat industry lobbyists. I've never seen anything like it in my reporting career. The effort, let's just say the effort was absolutely abandoned. Congress passed riders to defund it every single year, and it lays in tatters.
And that effort was no doubt led by people like Chuck Grassley, because I have no doubt that in Iowa, you know, this was something particularly unpleasant for them. And I imagine North Carolina, too, right?
Yeah, and I don't mean to contradict you. It is very interesting to me. Chuck Grassley is actually not black and white on this thing. He's
put
out a lot of statements that are pro competition and sort of pro farmer and anti consolidation, and a lot of the folks who killed this thing were Southern Democrats in poultry producing states like Georgia. I'm thinking David Scott was one of those. So the politics on this issue is just so weird, to be honest, and it kind of doesn't fit in directly into Republican-Democrat mold in many ways.
No, it just fits into who's been bought by who, evidently. I said that, not you. I don't mind saying things like that, because why not? Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry that Tyson is listening to me. The industry, when some of these reforms were proposed in 2011 by Vilsack et al., the industry said that the new rules would set them back by 50 years. Like, what did they mean by that? Like, how would it set them back? It would reduce their efficiency if they were forced to spin off into smaller companies? Or what are they talking about? Like, what kind of a defense is that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is the way I take it. And I don't think I'm putting words in anyone's mouth. I talked to Mark Dopp, the head lobbyist of the American Meat Institute, and what he meant by that was that these regulations would push back and unwind the new model of meat production, which is highly consolidated and centrally controlled. Just quickly, I mean, these poultry companies are what we call vertically integrated. They control all the means of production. The farmers are essentially employees who raise chickens under contract. We're seeing more and more hogs produced this way, under contract, without open markets to sell the product. We're seeing it increasing in the cattle space of more and more feedlots raising animals under contract for a big meat packer. Mm-hmm. And what the AMI was saying is, if you pass these rules, it is going to break this machine apart, break these networks apart, and make things much less efficient for us and messy. But in a way, you have to say that was kind of the stated goal of the regulation, which is to sort of start to unwind the control that these few firms have over the marketplace. So in a way, I think that they were accurate to say this would have pushed the industry back 50 years in some regards. And by that, I just mean in terms of competition and open markets. And if you look at the business 50 years ago, the top four producers controlled something like 20% of the market instead of 80% of the market.
Yeah, I mean, it'll set them back 50 years in terms of having to rediscover how to function within a competitive marketplace as opposed to setting prices. I want to quickly move along, though, because what your article was talking about was exactly this, the sort of consolidation of the market. And you made one point that I thought was really interesting, which is that the wholesalers seem to have more clout in terms of effecting change in the antitrust arena than the USDA itself, in as much as that these various wholesalers brought a very major suit for grievances surrounding price fixing, and they brought it against Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride, and a couple of the other big poultry packers. Tell us about that suit and what it might achieve. Are they gonna win, these wholesalers? And explain what exactly their grievance was.
You bet. And this is the most significant and interesting thing to happen in this issue for 8 years.
Yeah.
I mentioned before that monopolists, and I'm not saying that these companies have monopoly power. I guess I just want to be careful, but the problem with monopoly power is that you can depress what you pay farmers and raise prices for consumers.
Right.
Most of the action in this space has been around what happens to farmers on that side of the equation. Now, what's happening to consumers is the developments here have been much more recent. It's much more on the cutting edge. And there was a lawsuit filed this year, the Friday before Labor Day, which essentially argues that a handful of large chicken companies, including Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's Pride, Purdue, the suit argues that these firms have so much power that they can essentially coordinate with one another and cut supplies of chicken in a way that raises prices. They can collude to hold supplies off the market to keep prices high. That is the allegation of this lawsuit.
Right.
And as you kind of point out, it's interesting to me that the Department of Justice has been quiet on this issue, as has USDA, and this suit is coming from the private sector. And looking through this suit, you can see that they've done a lot of research, but a lot of it was from publicly available forums and outlets. They don't have subpoena power, and it seems like this is a kind of action that could have been brought relatively easily by DOJ, but it's being brought by private sector lawyers representing these wholesalers who would have been hurt if there had been illegal collusion.
Mm-hmm. So these are essentially the people who are suing these big companies, Tyson, Purdue, Pilgrim's Pride, et al. These are the guys, the middlemen, essentially. They're the guys who buy at a wholesale level from the big companies, and they're reselling it into retail outlets, whether it be grocery stores, restaurants, institutions, correct?
Absolutely. So the lead plaintiff is a company called Maplevale Farms, and yes, these are the wholesalers who are going to buy the semi-truckload of chicken from Tyson Foods,
right,
and then turn it around and sell it to a grocery store. But I do want to say, if this thing goes forward and goes to its ultimate conclusion, there could be a class of plaintiffs in this suit that would just be anyone who buys chicken, and that's 95% of Americans have been hypothetically harmed,
right,
by these allegations.
By price fixing. By price fixing. And the way they've been doing it is by holding chickens off the market, killing off breeder flocks, so that there is a short supply. Isn't that right? Isn't that what they've been doing? And they've all been sort of, according to the suit, they've been colluding at doing this kind of across the board, across the various companies. Am I correct in that?
All caps disclaimer, I'm being super careful in what I say.
Yeah, here. I understand.
So the allegation in the suit, well, let me just say what I know from my own reporting, which is that a company like Tyson Foods does strategically cut supplies when prices are low to keep supplies off the market and raise the price. I mean, that's common sense, right?
Sure.
But what's different today is that Tyson Foods owns the production infrastructure that used to be owned by over a dozen companies, because Tyson bought out all its competitors or many of its competitors during the 1980s. So it has tremendous leverage to cut supplies and raise prices. It was really sort of unheard of 20 years ago. Now, the suit alleges there's another layer to this, which is that Tyson Foods has been colluding or orchestrating these production cuts with its competitors, such as Pilgrim's Pride. That's what the suit alleges. And if that's the case, well, then you surely do cross a red line on antitrust law, which bans collusion. So,
yeah,
what they're saying is that these companies are strategically keeping supplies off the market to raise prices.
Fascinating. Okay, and then once this, we're going to talk about more about that in a second. But I also wanted to point out that there, you know, when I was doing the research for this interview, I read up on the fact that there has been a wave of what they call follow-on suits that are brought by shareholders for violating federal security laws where, quote, false and misleading, end quote, information was disseminated to said shareholders on the value of the company as a result of their price fixing. So can you explain how that works and what the impact on the share prices was and what does this all mean, you know, in sort of the bigger picture?
You bet. And let me just say, I've been reporting on this, for 12, 13 years. What's happened is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this lawsuit was filed before Labor Day. Tyson Foods alone, their stock is down about 22% from the day this lawsuit was filed.
Wow.
Tyson Foods CEO, who's named in the suit, now stepped down recently and is replaced by the president, might have nothing to do with the suit, but the stock fell dramatically even after that CEO stepped down.
Was that Donnie Smith? Was that
correct? That's Donnie Smith, who I interviewed for the book and who talked kind of at length about cutting supplies to keep prices high. So he stepped down, might have nothing to do with this suit, but Wall Street sure is nervous about the whole thing. And those lawsuits you're talking about are shareholder lawsuits saying, hey, Tyson Foods, you should have disclosed to us this risk that's happened. And frankly, it's sort of relatively common when you see an event like this tank, or when it hurt the value of a company's stock, you'll see shareholders step in and say, hey, you were not giving us the full picture. Now, how successful any of those suits will be on behalf of shareholders who say Tyson should have told them more about this is really an open question.
Yeah. Well, so what do these actions mean in terms of, for example, the farmers? And what about for consumers? Like if the price, say for example, the price fixing suit is successful and Tyson and their cohorts are in fact found guilty of colluding to fix prices, what will that mean for consumers? Will it have any impact on pricing going forward, or, and what will it mean for farmers? Will it have any impact on what they're paid per bird or per pound? What is the ultimate outcome, or is it really just about the share prices and people who own stock in those companies?
Oh, no. This is huge, potentially, for both consumers and farmers, and it's almost hard to think about it and unpack what might happen. I mean, this lawsuit is tremendous. The financial damages from this lawsuit, if it were to be successful, would be in the billions of dollars.
Wow.
And the attorneys are also seeking injunctive relief that would stop a lot of industry practices that these lawyers allege are anti-competitive. So it's sort of even hard to think about, but hypothetically, you know, it could mean for consumers that chicken prices would be lower. It certainly could be a headache for large chicken companies because, you know, historically this industry has been defined by volatility and boom and bust prices. And this lawsuit is saying that a stability of prices is anti-competitive. So these farmers could see, the companies could see more of a return to the past where prices go up and down more. I think that there's just no question that that would mean to consumers that prices would ultimately be lower going forward. The impact on farmers is secondary to this whole lawsuit, but could be significant. And I'll just leave it at that because, I mean, some of the allegations in this suit, you know, if the injunctions are put down, it could change, you know, parts of the machine and could change business practices for farmers. Sorry to be so vague.
No, you're not. What you make me think of now is that I think we should explain for people who haven't read The Meat Racket, incredible as that may be, because I consider it required reading. I think you should just briefly encapsulate what exactly takes place in a contract growing situation that explains how it is companies are able to keep prices low for contract farmers, because there is a very complex machinery behind that in terms of the way the contract is written, the lack of transparency in pricing, and the requirements that are placed on farmers in order to be able to continue to be awarded those contracts. So can you just give us a quick little thumbnail of how that works, and then maybe people will be able to see how these suits may well have an impact on the people who are in the business of growing birds.
Absolutely. Thank you. Perfect. And it's, first of all, stunning. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. I've covered lots of different industries. The chicken farming stands alone. It's just a almost unique method of production in agriculture. It's amazing. So the key term is vertical integration. Picture a town where lots of chicken is being raised, 40 years ago, you would have a local hatchery that sold eggs. You'd have farmers who raised birds. You'd have a slaughterhouse that bought the birds and slaughtered them. You'd have truckers who shipped the birds to the farm and then back to the slaughterhouse. These all used to be independent businesses. Mm-hmm. That changed starting around the 1960s, and you saw, quote-unquote, vertically integrated poultry production emerge as just a dominant model. And what that means is you've got one massive Tyson Foods plant in the middle of town with a hatchery, a slaughterhouse, and a feed mill, and a trucking line, all of its own by Tyson Foods. The farm is interesting in that it sort of stands apart. You've got these nominally independent chicken farmers who borrow millions of dollars from a bank, build a bunch of chicken houses, and then sign a contract to raise the birds for Tyson Foods. So Tyson delivers the baby chicks to the farm and then picks them up 6 weeks later. Incidentally, Tyson owns the birds the entire time. The chicken farmer never owns the most important asset on their farm, which is the birds.
Unless they're dead.
Oh, very good point. When the bird dies, ownership can transfer to the farmer. Tyson owns the feed. It formulates the feed. It picks the variety and genetics of the bird that's delivered. It sends veterinarians out to the farm to check on the birds. This used to be kind of a recipe for stability. That's why farmers signed up in the 60s and 70s. Right. As Tyson said, hey, you're basically babysitting these birds. You'll get a steady paycheck. We'll take a lot of the risk out of the bargain. But as the business has consolidated, you've seen a lot of change that essentially at the top line is that farmers get paid less for raising birds through lots of different mechanisms. But so how does this apply to what we're talking about? What this means now is Tyson Foods, for example, and Pilgrim's Pride's the same way, Purdue's mm-hmm. the same way.
Sanderson, company, yep, they all do it.
They all do it. With Tyson, thousands of chicken farms are now under the essential control of one company. And there's an office in Springdale, Arkansas, where Tyson is based, where the supply chain group is a bunch of people sitting around computers modeling out how many chickens they need to raise in a given quarter, what kinds of chickens they need to be raised, and then those orders are sort of transmitted out from the central office to thousands of farms throughout rural America. And they control down to the egg, essentially, how many chickens are going to be placed on each farm mm-hmm. and how many flocks of birds a farmer gets each year. These levers are subtly controlled and shifted at this central location. So when Tyson realizes, heck, next quarter looks pretty bad, they'll dial back the number of chicks they're going to place. They will incrementally increase the number of out time, the amount of out time between flocks at these farms, mm-hmm. and control production. Well, what that means for me as a farmer in Arkansas is that maybe I'm going to get five flocks this year instead of six, which is a big hit to my income.
That's right.
At the same time, I've got fixed prices for my rent and energy costs. Now, mm-hmm. this is just the tip of the iceberg, but that's one way to think about how some of these tactics can really impact farmers in rural America and how little control these farmers actually have over their operations.
Mm-hmm. It also highlights why it's so important to be aware of these monopolization or monopolistic practices. And as a consumer, because we're sort of running out of time, I'm going to ask you if you, because this is not, by the way, just for those who are listening, this model is not unique at all to the poultry industry. The hog industry has basically followed it lock, stock, and barrel. And the cattle industry, as Chris said earlier in the show, is following it in terms of how they manage feedlots. Although cattle ranching is quite a bit more independent than either of the other two protein groups. But Chris, what way would you suggest that consumers can fight back against this? Should we, should they stop buying that kind of poultry, or can they write letters to their congressman, or what is the remedy for this? I mean, to support congressional representation, in a now completely Republican-controlled Congress is kind of, I don't know. I mean, I hope it works, but what else can we do? How do consumers deal with this?
Yeah, and of course, standard disclaimer, my job is to report facts and give them to people to make decisions, and I always get a little queasy in terms of getting into the advocacy part of telling people what to do. But I get this question
all the
time.
We're counting on you.
Okay. I get this question all the time. Sure. And I will say, there's, if you're troubled by what's happening in the meat industry, there's an immediate opt-out option that unfortunately is a little more inconvenient and costs more money. But across the country, there are entrepreneurs in this space who are raising birds and selling them directly to consumers at local farmers markets. We bought our Thanksgiving turkey from a great farm called North Mountain Pastures in Pennsylvania, and I know the farmer directly. It was more expensive. There's no doubt about that. And we get our chicken from the same place. And people can do that immediately if they just want to opt out. Now,
there are also some bigger companies like Emmer, like Hip Chicks. There are new big poultry companies that are coming up that I think, I don't know for sure, but I don't think they practice quite the same way as the Tysons, Purdue's, Sandersons. Correct me if I'm wrong. But do you know about those? Do you know about those companies?
No, you're teaching me something here.
Oh, yeah.
I am not familiar with those. And
well, I've been looking. I want to do an article about, I want to write a piece about who is doing it right. And I must say that it is not easy to find these companies. And it is not easy to get a lot of information about it. But I'm sort of working my way towards that. And those are two poultry companies that you know, leapt out at me. There's another one called Smart Chicken, I think. That is also it's nationally distributed into grocery stores, as are Emmer, as are Hip Chicks, although those tend to be West Coast. But Smart Chicken is here on the East Coast, and I'm sure there are some other regional production companies that are, you know, familiar to people who live around the country who might be listening. But that, to me, is the way to fight back. Don't buy those big company birds. Don't buy those value-added products. Not that I want to tell people what to do, but I do. I love to tell people what to do. But before we go, because we have to leave in a few minutes, I want you to talk about the piece that you've been working on, which was the genesis of this conversation, and where people can access it and when it's going to be published, if you know that, and how much more they're going to learn.
Oh, well, so I'm reporting more, and I'm sorry to be lame. I'm reporting more on this topic and the antitrust issues relating to consumers and potential, you know, strategic supply cuts and things along those lines. I really hope the article is going to be along soon and maybe kind of open a window into, you know, how some of this stuff works and how the supply of chicken works. It's just, it's really interesting. It's really surprising. And I don't think many people know how it works. So I'll just, if it's okay, kind of leave it at that. And okay. I really hope the article's out soon. It would have been out a lot sooner if that tragic pipeline explosion hadn't happened
right
in Alabama.
You have a website, Chris?
Yeah, it's Christopher Leonard, all one word, .biz, or you can just Google the Meat Racket and Christopher Leonard and see that, and it's got some of the articles up there too. And again, I'm hoping this new one will be out relatively soon.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. People, read The Meat Racket. I mean, honest to God, I learned so much from that book. I can't thank you enough for writing it, Chris. You and Ted Genoways are two of my favorite journalists, and Maren McKenna, of course, who I also love. And you know, it was incredibly helpful to me when I was writing my own tiny little book that's coming out next spring, but which I will be making you promote shamelessly. No.
I look forward to it. Maybe I'll get the chance to turn the tables and interview you in your book.
That would be awesome.
What's the matter with meat, right?
Yeah, that's right. What's the matter with meat? Well, I'm going to tell you.
I'm looking forward to it.
But people are going to learn a lot more from reading your book than they are from mine. Mine is a global survey, so it's a little more, you know, enormous a topic, so, and a very short book. But anyway, enough about me and more about you. So, Chris Leonard, thank you so much for joining me. People, buy Chris Leonard's book. Oh, and Chris, I'm going to say goodbye, but now I'm going to read a thing about supporting the radio station. So, Chris, thank you very much for being on the show, and you and I will be in constant conversation in the future. Happy holiday to you, by the way.
You too. Thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate that. And now it's time for my PSA, which is that this program, What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, as well as every other program on this network is brought to you by the one and only Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported nonprofit. Yes, nonprofit. We do not take money. Nobody tells us what to say. I mean, we take money to run, but we don't take money that tells us what we can and cannot say on this program. So that's why you can hear me say things like, you know, Chuck Grassley is corrupt, or, you know, whatever I feel like saying, because that's what I can do. we are devoted to all things food, in case you didn't know that. There are 35 plus programs on this radio station. They cover every aspect of the industry, whether it's hospitality, whether it's cooking, whether it's recipe development, history, chemistry, you name it, it's covered. This is the only radio network of its type, as far as I know, anywhere in the world. And indeed, we have a global audience. But we need your support during the big end of year fundraiser. We really, really do need your support to grow. I, for instance, really want another freaking studio. And another, you know, and more than one engineer on call so that we can do some pre-produced programming. in order to do that, we need your money. So a contribution to this program or any of the program will support all of our 35 plus weekly programs. But in addition to supporting these excellent programs, of which, you know, whether you like mine or not is immaterial, the other ones are great too. It also comes with exclusive member benefits like a monthly best of playlist, some very, very swanky swag. You get discounted event tickets. You get members only parties. You get to come and meet and greet with the rest of the hosts. A lot of us are real experts in our field. So if you're truly interested in whatever it is, whether it's being a restaurateur or becoming a chef, whatever it is you want to know about the food industry, you can find it here on Heritage Radio Network. And at one of our host events, you can talk to those of us who really know what we're talking about. And so if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little money. Press the donate button, people. Come on. You can donate to Heritage Radio Network by going to heritageradionetwork.org. Press the donate button and give as much as you can, as much or as little. You know, every little bit helps. All the money that we raise really just goes to like paying our rent, paying our full-time staff. So, you know, those guys need salaries. They need to be paid. So that we can continue to bring this kind of programming, which is absolutely unique to the Heritage Radio Network. So be generous if you can. And thanks so much for listening. And thanks again, as always, to my excellent sponsor, New York.
State.
State. Grown. And certified. Program. Thank you, Dave. I don't know why I can't get that straight. It's my encroaching senility. I know. It's, you know, hey, you turn 60 and it's like your whole memory just disappears. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Press the donate button and we'll see you next week. Next week, I have a total showstopper for you. Kathleen Merrigan, former Undersecretary of State with Tom Vilsack for the first Obama term, is going to be joining me. We're going to be talking about antitrust and much, much more. So please join me next week on Monday for Kathleen Merrigan. Thanks for listening today. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.